All right, 909 here. We're joined by Ben Keys, who rejoins us. He was on earlier, and I forgot exactly when it was, Ben, but it's good to have you back. Professor of Real Estate and Finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back. Hope you're doing well.
Yes, sir, I am. You know, it seems like a year ago that Hurricane Beryl hit Texas, although it was July earlier in hurricane season. We're later in hurricane season, a lot of activity in the Atlantic. Thankfully, none of it threatening any of us. As it stands now, there is this system in the Gulf that they're watching. They don't know what could turn up with that. And of course, we had Helene that just spun up and devastated a lot of the country. And as I was looking at that, Ben, I was thinking, you know, people after Katrina were saying, and to be clear, Katrina was a failure of the levee system, not necessarily the storm, because the storm missed New Orleans, it hit Mississippi. People would say, you know, that, well, maybe you shouldn't live there. And as I was watching the track of Helene and the damage that it caused, I don't know that that's an argument anymore when you look at, say, places like Asheville or areas of North Carolina that are, what, 2,000 feet up and 300 miles inland, right?
Yeah, and I mean, as a place to start, it's, you know, the footage from that area is just heartbreaking. You know, I think that it is this idea that that there's somewhere that is immune to our changing climate is just a myth. You know, we're seeing warmer temperatures in the Gulf, and that's leading to different types of storms, which can take this type of form, which you know, end up moving very slowly and dropping enormous amounts of rain. And, you know, it was a very similar experience all the way up in Vermont last year with a tremendous amount of flooding there. Again, you know, many miles inland up in the mountains in New England, areas that have been promoted as being sort of climate safe, you know, places to move to or places to retire to. And I think it's just going to take a big shift in how we think about the nature of these risks, which is that no one's immune, and that every community and every, you know, individual needs to have the right amount of protection when it comes to insurance and when it comes to building up infrastructure and resilience.
I think I might have said this last time, but when it comes to, you know, science and politics, they never get along. And when I try to decide what's real and what's not, I look to the military, I look to science, and I look to Wall Street, because that'll pretty well tell you what's happening, or big business, right? What's real and what's not. And let me get off my soapbox here, and then you can talk. When it comes to insurance, it's all based on, the model of insurance is based on, the people that don't claim anything pay for the people that do. And that's how insurance companies stay in business. It's actuarial tables. And the problem is, when they have to pay out more than they take in, somebody's got to make up that difference. The insurance model is based on people that don't make claims on the insurance, paying premiums and that cover the claims for the people that do. I'm presenting that terribly clumsy, because you know why, Ben? I didn't go to the Wharton School of Business. But am I close there with what I'm trying to stumble through?
You've got it. Yes. You know, an insurance, and this is what I've been studying in a lot of detail these last few years, is looking at connections between climate change and then insurance, mortgage, and housing markets. Insurance markets function because of risk pooling. And so you're going to be combining a lot of people under the same provider of insurance. The expectation is that not everyone in that risk pool will be harmed by a risk over, say, a given calendar year, and essentially you're able to transfer the claims from those who were affected to those who weren't. I think intuitively it might work with the best when we're thinking about something like an auto insurance policy, where, you know, car accidents are idiosyncratic, and, you know, if someone that you know is in a fender bender, you know, their claims to get their car repaired are going to come out of the premiums that you and I, who might not have been in an accident that year, are going to pay in. And so that's how the system has to work, is you need enough of a risk pool that's shared across, you know, a range of probabilities, like you alluded to, actuarial tables, that's going to provide enough diversification for the insurance company to do their job. And also, at the end of the day, these are for-profit companies that are looking to turn a profit at the end of the day. So they do want the premiums to be, you know, greater than the claims they pay out.
So that being said, there is not a doubt that the climate is changing, is there?
That's right. That's right. There's really no question, and it's a scientific certainty at this point, and we're seeing it in a variety of different ways, whether that's droughts that are leading to more wildfires, whether that's the intensity of hurricanes, whether it's rising sea levels, and there's really no question there. You know, I'm an economist by training. I'm not a climate scientist. Mm-hmm. But I read the climate literature quite closely, and I talk with people. And you know, as you were saying, like, you know, look to those who you trust.
Yep.
When you look to the U.S. military and the reports that have been put out year after year about how they are reconsidering the location of many bases and investing heavily in infrastructure on coastal bases, they are very transparent that this is because of a changing climate. And when you talk to the insurance and reinsurance industry, they make this point over and over again, which is, you know, look, the disaster risks that we face are simply different than they were 20 or 25 years ago.
And I'm not saying that big business will never lie to you. I'm saying that when it comes to their operations, you can look to that to see what the truth is and what the realities are and what the realities are not. Accurate?
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, they have to put their money where their mouth is. The insurance and reinsurance businesses are really in this first loss position when a disaster occurs. And so they're very sensitive to the realities on the ground. And that means they've invested, you know, billions of dollars in data collection, in climate modeling, and to really understand the changing nature of catastrophes related to climate.
So when it comes to hurricanes, you know, they make these predictions, and then we always gauge it here by, you know, well, if we were affected by one, and we had, what was the one we were here for, Tim? I forgot the name of it that we stayed overnight for, the hurricane. Do you remember? Francine, was it? I think, yeah. I get them confused because we're here, you know, 48 hours without sleep, and it all runs together. But we did have one that impacted the area. Thankfully, it was not to those that didn't have any damage. It wasn't that serious. But then we go to the predictions and we say, well, maybe they didn't pan out. But when you look at all of the named storms, that some are out in the Atlantic, like right now, it does pan out. But the point I'm trying to make here, I guess, Ben, is that when you look at a storm and the impacts all the way through North Carolina, that affects the reinsurance market or not?
Absolutely. It affects insurers and reinsurers. You know, the aftermath of these disasters is an enormous challenge for the communities on the ground as they attempt to rebuild their communities and rebuild their lives. And, you know, a really important player in that rebuilding process are the insurance companies who, you know, are then assessing the damage and paying out claims. And when there's a very large volume of those claims, that's going to potentially impair some insurance companies who may not have had enough of a cushion of as you were, we were talking about the risk pool, right? Enough of other premiums or a sort of, you know, savings account, capital pile to pay out those claims. We've seen a number of insurers fail, especially in the Florida market in the last couple of years. They're also going to lean on the reinsurance market. And reinsurance is essentially insurance for insurance companies. Insurance companies are worried about staying solvent. And so for certain types of disasters, they're going to go and take out an insurance policy on the policies that they themselves are writing. And it tends to be very focused on concentrated catastrophic risk. And so they are going to be worried about a big storm hitting a major metro area. For a disaster like this recent one with Helene, the estimates are already out there that maybe only a quarter of the damage is going to be fully insured. And that's a function of undercoverage, so homeowners not having enough coverage on their property, and then the lack of take-up of flood insurance that many households around the country who are in flood, you know, potential areas but not high likelihood of flood. So outside of that 1-in-100-year floodplain, very unlikely to take up flood insurance. And so unfortunately, flood insurance is not covered by most homeowners policies, even up in the mountains of Asheville. And so what that means is that there are going to be a lot of people who are actually going to have substantial losses without an insurer sort of to support their recovery efforts.
So to make a radio graphic, if I can, I know that seems oxymoronic, but if you take the path of Helene, if you draw a circle at the bottom there along the coast, along Florida, maybe that's who the insurance companies expected they would have to pay claims for at some point, and those are the people that they paid premiums. But all the people that are in the path beyond that paid premiums, and they were paying into the pool, and that's what the insurance companies were counting on. They were not counting on claims from people all the way up, correct?
Yeah, and it's this dual layer nature of insurance where we have, you know, most homeowners insurance in the U.S. is privately provided by these, you know, private market insurers. We are seeing a rise in these state fair plans, this kind of insurer of last resort, especially common in Florida and growing in Louisiana and elsewhere. But the flood insurance has been carved out
and that's where we're going to take a break, Ben, because I wanted to bring you to flood insurance, because a lot of people are saying, well, maybe there should be a national insurance plan, a national disaster insurance plan, and do away with private homeowners insurance. Or I don't know how you would parse what's a disaster and what's not. And then I say to people when they say, well, that's what you need. Well, look, how flood insurance, how is that working out for you? And mine's gone from $300 to $900 despite the improvements that the Corps of Engineers has made. So we'll talk about all of that. And then there's always the Commerce Clause, and can you force people to buy insurance or can't you? There's also the Federal Treasury and FEMA, and if they bail people out that didn't have flood insurance, ultimately we're all paying for that one way or the other, right, from an economic standpoint?
That's right.
So it's a Rubik's Cube. We'll continue to try to turn it all around and try to put it together when we come back with Ben Keyes. I'm getting a lot of texts here from people, too, and I mentioned this on the air yesterday. It seems as though now insurance companies are calling people and telling them they're overinsured and trying to get them to drop their coverage, which I'm sorry, no disrespect to my agent, but I smell a rat when I get a call like that, because I'm thinking, well, are you really trying to save me money? And if you're going to collect premiums that you won't have to pay out on, why wouldn't you do that? We'll talk more when we come back. You got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. Ben Keyes, our guest, professor of real estate finance, University of Pennsylvania's prestigious Wharton School of Business, back in a flash on WWL. Talking to Ben Keyes, professor of real estate finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, and this can be kind of complicated. I'm trying not to go all over the place too much, but I want to get you text in also at 504-260-1870. Professor, let me make this statement. You can tell me if it's accurate or not. Given climate change, the current insurance model is unsustainable. Accurate or not?
I think it's close to accurate. I think, you know, we have, you know, I think insurance is a very misunderstood market in a lot of ways. It is a very heavily regulated market. Every state basically has control of the homeowners insurance market, and there isn't really federal a role for federal oversight. And I think, you know, that the basic model of homeowners insurance was previously very boring, was very predictable, and generally the insurance premium that you paid this year was probably something very close to the premium that you paid the year before. And I think that has changed dramatically in these last few years. My research has shown a 34% increase nationwide in premiums from 2020 to 2023, and substantially higher increases than that in higher risk parts of the country, like where most of your listeners are. And so, you know, I think that creates a level of uncertainty around the cost of living in an area that just simply wasn't the case even a few years ago. And I think that is going to push us to rethink how we regulate and how we structure insurance contracts, whether we need long-term insurance contracts, whether we need community-level insurance contracts, and then, as you alluded to before, whether we need something that looks more like a public-private partnership to defray some of the costs, these rising costs of insurance.
And to be clear, when I say unsustainable, it's like, and I always quote this example of a contractor telling you, we can do anything you want if you have the money. So if you keep raising premiums, right, I mean, you can sustain it all you want. However, from the economic standpoint, there's only a limited amount of money or that people can pay in some instances or in a lot of instances.
Exactly, and I think that's the tension in the market right now, which is as insurers raise their premiums, they're not just they're partly trying to signal the risk. So part of what insurers can do is on an annual basis they can raise your premiums to say this is reflective of what we believe the appropriate amount of risk is, and they're again alluding back to your actuarial tables. They're trying to price things in a way that is actuarially fair and consistent. So it's communicating information to homeowners when you see those premiums go up. But at the same time, it is having a direct effect on households' bank accounts. It's having a direct effect on their pocketbooks. And what that means is that households are going to have to adjust. And so some of that is going to be shopping around for a different insurance provider. Some of that might be taking on less insurance and having less coverage. And in some very unfortunate cases, it means dropping coverage altogether because you're just priced out of the market. And, you know, in that case, the insurance companies are fine. They can go and operate elsewhere. But the amount of risk in, you know, that for that household or that community is unchanged. And so in many ways, they're more exposed. And so I think that's one of the real tensions when you have, you know, insurance premiums increasing so rapidly is that it is putting a lot of households in a very tough spot where they're going to have to make hard choices about, you know, how much coverage can I afford?
And that brings us to flood insurance. I had Senator Bill Cassidy on yesterday, and he said he thinks that FEMA is trying to make up for all of the Katrina losses by raising the rates. And he did point out accurately that Katrina, as I said earlier, missed the city. Katrina hit Mississippi, and it was a failure of the flood system that caused the damage here, the federally built flood system. Along those lines, people in North Carolina didn't think they needed flood insurance. If everybody paid into the pool, then maybe that would spread out the risk. He said he has a hard time getting people in Utah and Wyoming to buy into that. So how do you, I don't know, and people are texting in about a national plan. I know, you know, the old thing used to be, if you like the post office, you'll love, no disrespect, if you like the post office, you'll love nationalized blank, right? Fill in the blank. How do you see this playing out economically? Because if the current model as it stands, given climate change, is unsustainable, I don't know what happens other than people, somebody's going to have to eat all of this money, right? If people have mortgages on homes, I don't know if you can have a mortgage on a home that's not in a flood zone, that's not covered against flood, and what happens then? The mortgage company eats it and the people walk away?
Yeah, I mean, it sadly does come down to this question of who's going to eat the losses. You know, the world is becoming a riskier place, and we've seen a dramatic increase in the number and the amount of damage that's been induced by disasters. It's basically quadrupled since the 1980s. And so what that means is that everyone needs to pay more, and it becomes a question of how are we going to share those costs. And I think you can see the perspective from a few different ways. One is we should spread the risk as widely as possible across the entire country, ideally. And in that case, that's going to drive down the costs for everybody. But at the same time, what that's going to do is it's going to cross-subsidize different parts of the country. And so people who live in a safe, cornfield community in Iowa are going to be paying into an insurance program that they probably won't benefit from, whereas coastal residents will pay a subsidized rate. And it comes back to this question of fairness. Should we be thinking about pricing risk in a way that's actuarially fair from an insurer standpoint? Like, hey, if you are a risky driver, you should pay more for your insurance. Or should we think about fairness in terms of everyone bearing some of these costs? Just to add one historical note to this, with the creation of the National Flood Insurance Program, it was sort of intentionally underpriced when it was rolled out. The idea was that they wanted to encourage take-up of this new federal program. And one way to do that is to lower the price. You basically give people a discount and you say, hey, super cheap flood insurance, you should really take up a policy. Well, that's a great way to get people to take up. But guess what? As soon as they're on the policy, they're going to be very upset when those premiums rise. And so that program really lacked the political will to raise premiums to align with the actual costs of payouts for decades. So they ran billions of dollars in deficits that every taxpayer in the United States were paying into. And it's only with this recent reform of risk rating 2.0 that we're seeing big changes to the pricing of that flood insurance program. And so I think this is one of the key concerns with rolling out a national program. Is there going to be political will to price the risk appropriately, and how much of this cross-subsidization from safer areas to risky areas do we want to do?
Subsidy or subsidization is a politically charged term, as you well know, Ben, but in essence, that's the way the insurance model works, right? People that the insurance companies deem to have minimal risk are subsidizing the people that have the higher risk? Yes? No?
Yeah, and so it becomes a question of how closely are the insurers pricing the individual's risk versus pooling everyone together and offering everyone the same rate. So if you're driving a super fancy sports car that can go 140 miles an hour and I'm driving my Honda Accord, I might not feel that it's very fair that we pay the same amount in auto insurance if you're a much riskier driver than I am. And so there's an incentive for an insurance company to come in and say, hey, we're only going to insure Honda Accords, the safe, boring dad car. And so that kind of pooling of risk is going to separate out. And what you're going to be left with is a pool of very risky drivers in one insurance company and the very safe ones in a different one. I think the challenge for a federal program like the National Flood Insurance Program is, you know, the people who buy into it are the very riskiest people. Those are the people who are expecting flood damage, whereas most of the country doesn't buy into the flood insurance program. And so they're left with this selected pool of policyholders. And I think this is one of the tensions that they face. And it means that setting rates can be quite challenging because they need to be quite high.
Again, subsidy being a politically charged word, I'm getting texts from different people saying, stop sending money overseas. Stop giving $56 billion to Ukraine. But either way, that's taxpayer money, right? One way or the other, however you look at it, it's taxpayer money, or it's money printed by the federal government that's going to go into the debt column. So I think sometimes people don't understand where the different piles of money come from. Did you say an Accord was a boring dad car?
I did. I was picking on myself.
Well, where
on
would
that
a 20,
one.
Where would a 2014 CRV fit into that, Ben? Because that's what I'm. That's my ride. Let me take a
You're
break.
Right there.
Yeah,
You're right
I'm right
there with
you.
Then.
Yeah. Well, let me take a break. We come back. I want to talk about. And it's anecdotal, but I've gotten a lot of people that have talked to me saying, and it happened to me as well, about insurance companies calling them, contacting, saying maybe you're overinsured. Yeah, you'd like to think that when an insurance company calls you telling you, you pay me less, that something good is behind it, but I'm too cynical to believe that. We'll address that when we come back. Ben Keyes, our guest, professor of real estate and finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. I know somebody whose wife was an actuary, and she went to school for about 8 years to become one. So it's a very complicated art/science when it comes to predicting risk. We'll pick it up. We come back, 938, Traffic Now, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Ben Keyes, professor of real estate finance at the prestigious University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. And I say that not only because our CEO went there, but because it's true. Ben, I mentioned earlier, and I don't know if this is anecdotal, I don't know if this is industry-wide or not, but insurance companies calling saying, hey, maybe you're overinsured, maybe we can drop your premium. I understand, much like a bookmaker, they're trying to lay the book off so they don't have a lot of liability on their books, but by the same token, they're not going to pay a claim for something that doesn't exist, so I'm a little confused about that.
Yeah, I'm a bit concerned about that one as well. And I haven't seen any hard data on this, but it certainly sounds exactly along the lines that you're describing as a bookmaker trying to balance the bets on either side. Similar idea is that they're trying to reduce their exposure.
Right.
I think it's important for people to shop around.
But wait, let me interrupt for 1 second. And this goes to the insurance model, and maybe it'll help us all understand this. If they're collecting a premium from me, say a $6,000 premium that could be $4,000, but yet I would have to document the damages that I had in order for them to reimburse me, well, that's all gravy on their side. Why wouldn't they continue to collect that premium?
Well, there may be other changes to the contract that they're also hoping to introduce.
It may not
just be that they're changing the premium. They may be changing the coverage. They may be asking
there
for a change in the deductible.
Okay.
There may be a change in the perils that are covered or the degree of coverage related to, are you going to replace the roof or are you going to replace the current value of the roof, right? So I think, you know, you have to be careful in reading the fine print.
The light bulb went off, Ben Keyes. You lit the bulb for me. You did.
I'm happy to hear it. I think there's, I think a lack of shopping around in homeowners insurance markets. There's a reason why so many TV commercials are Flo from Progressive or Jake from State Farm or all of our other TV personality friends. I think that most people are not shopping around very aggressively, and so what the insurance companies know is that if you lock it in at one point, maybe when you're buying a house or when you refinance a mortgage, you're likely to just automatically renew it year after year, and it becomes something that is, from the insurance company's perspective, almost like a bond, like that predictable in terms of their income, their cash flow. And I don't think people realize just how much dispersion there is in the offers that you receive. If you shop around, you might find very different prices from a very different insurance company for the exact same policy. Again, with that caveat, you have to read the fine print to make sure that it's covering, you know, the same amounts. The other piece is that in many states, insurance premiums are tied to credit scores. And so if you have seen your credit score improve over the last year or so, you should absolutely shop around for a lower rate.
Are there comparisons to be made? Well, wait, let me check that question because I want to get this one in first. When it comes to homeowners and flood being merged into one or requiring all homeowners to carry flood insurance, could that be done through federal law by mortgage regulation, or is that a state thing, or what?
So regulation of the insurance industry is almost entirely at the state level. Mm-hmm. You could imagine an entity like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac requiring additional coverage. My sense is that they are enforcing insurance requirements more stringently than they have in the past, given the frequency of disasters in the last few years. So you could see kind of a federal policy come down through the mortgage market. But generally that would be on a state-by-state basis, as with most things in insurance regulation.
And I ask that because, the flood insurance program, FEMA, runs public service announcements. You might remember the little dachshund floating on a pillow or whatever it was, saying everybody should have flood insurance. However, not everybody's buying into that, and that's why there's the hole in the flood insurance program that there is, and that people in Louisiana and affected states are trying to look into 2.0 and say what's the methodology behind it, et cetera. That being said, are there comparisons to be made between this and health insurance for people that here's the thing. If you don't have flood insurance and you get flooded out, you're going to use all of your assets, and then at that point you go on the federal dole, right, or you go on the state dole. When it comes to health insurance, if you don't have insurance, you could go to the emergency room or you're going to spend all of your assets, and then you'll go on Medicaid or Medicare, what have you, and then you'll be at the mercy of the state, and they'll be providing coverage. The taxpayers pick it up. Are there comparisons to be made between these two in an argument for or against national insurance either way?
I think so. I think it's a nice point, and there's clearly a need for government backstops in this space, just like we don't think it's appropriate for anyone to be without healthcare insurance. It is also, appropriate to create programs to protect homeowners when the private market refuses to offer them policies. And so I think that, there's a very clear parallel there to some of the markets that have been set up in recent years, thanks to Obamacare, that I think parallel some of the state fair plans, quite closely, actually, in terms of the benefits there. I think there is also this broader issue in thinking about the costs of being uninsured or underinsured and the ripple effects that can have both for households and for thinking about a government's balance sheet. And, you know, in many cases, you know, this is the old adage, right? It's a stitch in time to get people insurance up front, and that can help them in so many ways rather than the ripple effects on the back end and the kind of spiral that people can suffer through. I've been doing some research on the Federal Disaster Loan Program, which is a program that offers loans through the Small Business Administration to both businesses and households in the aftermath of a disaster. And we're finding that that loan program has big beneficial effects for those who receive the loans. They're less likely to, I think the number we find is about 60% less likely to file for bankruptcy over the next 3.5 years. So, you know, there's sort of big, longer-term benefits in it, and it points to the addressing people's upfront needs and worrying about it more on the front end rather than backloading it and saying, we'll sort this out through other aid and assistance programs, you know, potentially many years down the line.
And somebody texted in, I think it's a good point, that said there is no state without risk, and we've often had those conversations, you know, well, if it's here, it's an earthquake, or if you live there, it's a landslide, or if you live there, it could be a wildfire, tsunami, or what have you, depending on where you live. And that being said, that I don't know if that affects, again, the whole pool of ratepayers where, and with the reinsurance market, and this is where it gets very, very complicated, do we as homeowners in Louisiana wind up paying for claims made by State Farm that they write again to protect against wildfires in the West and so forth?
Yeah, and there's been some research which points to differences in state regulation as being one of the potential drivers for that. But that's exactly, you know, to the point I was making earlier, that we are, you know, in many ways part of a giant risk pool when we have these policies and these insurance companies are trying to spread the risks across the country with the hopes that they're not all going to hit at the same time, the sort of, you know, perfect storm series of disasters around the country. And then those premiums that are collected in one part of the country are going to cover claims elsewhere. I think it's also to the point I was making about Vermont earlier, that there really is no place that's immune from these our changing climate. And so it's really a matter of degrees rather than a yes or no question. There are certainly places that are more vulnerable than others. And I think just, you know, to put my professor hat back on for a second, I think one of the key elements to this is how do we make the tough choices going forward, whether it's, you know, do we invest in more infrastructure, do we make households and communities more resilient, or do we find smart ways to shift some of the areas where we live and where we work away from the most vulnerable locations. And so I think there's this kind of long-term challenge that we're going to be facing and trying to balance that with the short-term of, you know, the pain to households' pocketbooks.
One incontrovertible fact is that the climate is going to continue to change, is it not, barring anything that anybody does to prevent that?
There's no question. There's no question that a warming climate is going to lead to only exacerbating these problems. We are going to see the seas continue to rise, the temperatures continue to increase, the frequency of wildfires and droughts increasing, and the damage from these storms continue to grow. We've also had about 30 or 40 years now, really, you know, going back to the popularity of air conditioning systems, where we've seen a large southern migration in the United States. We've seen people moving from north to south, and that's moving people into harm's way. There's a really nice piece with some maps in the New York Times from just, I believe it was yesterday, where Americans have been moving into disaster-prone areas, and some very nice maps that show that, you know, the population of this country is moving into more risk-prone areas, and that is amplifying this problem.
And we have to go, but real quick, 1 minute left. Does inequity of wealth have anything to do with this problem at all in a country, or disparity of wealth?
For sure, but we're an incredibly wealthy country. We have $35 trillion of home equity in the U.S., and so when we're talking about $20 billion for FEMA or $60 billion for Ukraine, as you mentioned before, we're a rich country. We can do big, important things, and this is a solvable problem if we're willing to put our minds and our money to it.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Ben, and insight as always. We'll talk to you again soon, because this is not going to change or go away. Ben Keyes, professor of real estate finance, University of Pennsylvania's prestigious Wharton School of Business. We'll take a break, come back, and talk to Newell and see what he's got for us today on WWL.